today on Against the Grain, how did residents of shack settlements in South Africa become a formidable political force? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Yusuf al-Balushi about his book Ruptures in the Afterlife of the Apartheid City, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 500,000 people live in shack settlements in the city of Durban, South Africa. They endure poverty, substandard and often squalid living conditions, and state violence. They, many of them, have also organized themselves politically into an organization called Abahlali. So what does this, the shack dweller movement, stand for, and what are its goals? What's enabled it to build power and flex it? Yusuf al-Balushi believes there is much to learn from the stances Abahlali has taken and its modes of struggle. Yusuf is Associate Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine. His new book is Ruptures in the Afterlife of the Apartheid City. When Yusuf and I connected recently, I asked what happened to the radical political projects of the anti-apartheid movement when South African apartheid ended in 1994.
Those projects were, in a sense, derailed initially by the first transition that South Africa went through from an apartheid system of government to one that was supposed to be democratic, one person, one vote. The original radical promises that the African National Congress had signed up for, and that really the vast majority of the anti-apartheid movement had promoted all along, which included things like land redistribution, jobs for all, a much more robust understanding of equality than what was achieved, at least initially, were in a sense sidelined during the early 1990s, especially between 1990 and 1994, and then into the mid-90s, as the ruling African National Congress made a series of compromises with the former white ruling government in order, in their mind, to achieve a peaceful transition. This was a very precarious moment. Nelson Mandela had been released from prison, and it was clear that the old system of rule, under which the majority black population was entirely disenfranchised, could no longer survive. But people didn't know what would replace it. And there was the specter of civil war, certainly of ongoing armed conflict between the white minority settler government and citizenry and the majority people of color, who in South Africa are comprised of Africans, Indians or Asians, and the colored community, but also the prospect of a civil war amongst competing sides in the anti-apartheid movement, most prominently between the African National Congress and the Inkatha movement, which is located in the province of Natal, what became KwaZulu-Natal. And the Inkatha movement was a kind of Zulu nationalist movement, an ethnic movement that really flew in the face of the kind of multiracial emphasis that the African National Congress had put front and center in their politics. So the violence in the early 1990s threatened to destabilize this transition and threatened to turn into a civil war, something that other African countries had gone through at the exact same time. We remember that Rwanda went through a horrific genocide in 1994. And in order to stave off that violence, the ANC wanted to shepherd in a rapid transition that would ensure relative peace, and in so doing, it compromised on some of its more radical economic priorities in order to appease the white minority, and it also compromised on its notion of detribalizing society by giving a certain amount of power to the ruling chiefs, quote-unquote chiefs, principally among them the ruling Zulu chief, in order to appease the Inkatha movement. That occurred at the same time, we should remember, as the rise of neoliberalism was spreading around the world, and when in the domain of international politics, it was thought that radical socialist communist projects were bankrupt, right, after the fall of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc socialist countries. So the ANC inherited a global political conjuncture that was really overdetermined by the sense that now the entire world would embrace liberal free market democracies, what were really neoliberal political economic structures. And they had to, in a sense, compete for resources on an international terrain where neoliberalism was the name of the game. At the same time, we should, and this is the last thing I'll say about what crippled the transition, this original commitment to a radical transition, approximately 1 million of the 5 million white South Africans who had concentrated so many resources in their own hands up and left the country. And in addition to that physical flight of people, knowledge, resources, there was tremendous white capital flight. White business owners moved their headquarters out of the country or entirely moved their businesses out of the country to the London Stock Exchange, moved to Australia, and took their resources with them. So that's the context of what the African National Congress government inherited, and it partially explains some of the compromises that they ended up making with more mainstream approaches to government.
You note that the situation of poor people in South Africa did not change significantly over the course of Nelson Mandela's first and only term in office. He led the country from 1994 to 1999. And this created a lot of dissatisfaction and resentment on the part of poor blacks, especially in South Africa. You identify a number of phases of popular struggle that you write challenged the continuity and the disposability of black life between apartheid and what emerged in its wake. What happened in the first phase of popular struggle, which you indicate ran from 1999 to 2004?
This was a period of a kind of initial rupture with the post-apartheid consensus, which I think is best understood through the kind of popular ways in which Nelson Mandela was converted in the eyes of the West and in most of the world from what Thatcher called initially a dangerous black terrorist, right? This was someone who was considered a threat to the West and to liberalism. And he was converted from that into the figure who had brought about reconciliation, had transitioned South African society out of apartheid and into democracy, into a multiracial democracy that was referred to as kind of a rainbow government, right, in which all peoples, all races would have a place in the new society. So his refusal to engage in more radical forms of economic distribution and political enfranchisement for the majority of South Africans was celebrated. It's part of what gained him acceptance in the international terrain. And it produced a kind of welcoming of South Africa into the international community, quote unquote, as now a member of liberal free market democracies. But this initial period of movement upheaval, which, as you said, I locate roughly between 1999 and 2004, ruptured with all of those ideas, right? It burst the bubble, the mirage that South Africa had helped export around the world, that it had transitioned out of an unjust racist society into a more equal socially just society. And the people who initially ruptured that post-apartheid consensus were largely poor people scattered throughout the country, first and foremost those who were living with HIV and AIDS. Right? This was a clear indicator that not all was well in post-apartheid South Africa. Right? The dramatic rise in people living with HIV and AIDS in South Africa at the same time that their own liberation government was de facto basically a denialist government when it came to the reality of HIV and AIDS. It didn't want to deal with it. And so the Treatment Action Campaign became really famous for taking forms of direct action, disrupting the normalcy of the post-apartheid consensus moment, and really denouncing the horrific response or lack of a response of this post-apartheid government, and making those interventions not just on the technical terrain of healthcare, but aligning them with an analysis of socioeconomic inequality and the persistence of racism into the post-apartheid moment. The Treatment Action Campaign was careful, however, not to fully rupture with the ruling African National Congress or its broader alliance that included the South African Communist Party and the Congress of South African Trade Unions. It positioned itself kind of as inside that coalition, but as an internal critic, one that was going to hold their feet to the fire through forms of direct action and public protest. Other parallel movements during this first sequence of rupture in this period from 1999 to 2004 included groups like the anti-eviction campaign, organizing around housing and the fact that one of the central struggles under apartheid was against evictions, right? This is how the apartheid government relocated people of color, right? It actually evicted people of color who were living in mixed neighborhoods in order to relocate them in state-planned townships, which were racially and ethnically segregated and coded. So you had a white city separate from African townships, Indian townships, colored townships, and many African people were forcibly relocated from urban areas entirely into what were known as rural homelands. So part of the post-apartheid moment, right, the transition out of apartheid was supposed to be a refusal to engage in any parallel forms of eviction. But now, for economic reasons, people were still being evicted from their homes, and the anti-eviction campaign organized around the ongoing nature of evictions, especially in the province of the Western Cape and the city of Cape Town. A third movement that was really prominent around this time was the Anti-Privatization Forum, based primarily in the Johannesburg area, and they organized around the threat of the commodification of services. Right. One of the promises of the anti-apartheid struggle was that people would have their basic needs met. They would have access not only to houses, but to water, to electricity. And because the African National Congress emerged in the 1990s at a time when neoliberalism was the ruling set of ideas, they began to engage in a series of profit recovery measures in which they would provide you with those services or introduce them if they could recover the costs of them, charge poor people who just emerged out of an apartheid system of government who didn't have any resources to pay for such services, but the ANC wanted them to pay. So they were commodifying the delivery of such services. And the Anti-Privatization Forum mobilized around these everyday needs of people, but linked those struggles to the broader opposition to neoliberalism. And another really important movement that emerged around this time was the Landless People's Movement, that was fighting for land redistribution, right? And was highlighting the fact that the post-apartheid ruling government had failed to embark on any significant land reform at all. And that was perhaps the most important struggle objective, to redistribute the land that had been stolen under apartheid and under colonialism prior to apartheid, as a result of 400 years of colonialism, starting in the 1650s, the indigenous population had been dispossessed. And starting in the 1910s, laws were passed to dispossess them and prevent them from ever owning property and to keep that land in the hands of the white minority.
Yusuf al-Balushi is Associate Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine. His new book is Ruptures in the Afterlife of the Apartheid City. We have a link to that on againsttothegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. A second phase of revolt occurred in post-apartheid South Africa from 2004 to 2012. Can you give us briefly a sense of how the second phase of revolt differed from the first?
Part of what characterized this period was the demise of those initial new social movements that had emerged to rupture with the ruling post-apartheid consensus from 1999 to 2004. As a result of a series of specific reasons, complications, and internal debates and struggles around funding and state repression, it should be said, most of those movements began to meet their demise around 2004 and struggled to persist beyond that in really meaningful ways. But this did not mean that mass discontent was stemmed in any shape or form. In fact, we saw the number of protests and violent confrontations between the state and the citizenry go up in the next phase from 2004 to 2012. So protest, discontent, and violent confrontation with the state goes up even as formally organized new social movements began to break apart and struggle to endure for a variety of reasons. So it's for that reason that scholars have termed this second sequence of revolt a movement beyond movements, which is the term that Gillian Hart uses, quite an apt term, or a rebellion of the poor, which is to say it was a mass rebellion of poor people, but kind of in the sense that we tend to understand rebellion, not necessarily organized intentionally by formal structures or with a clear leadership or representative body calling the shots. So that was kind of the dominant trend during this second sequence of rupture, right? And we should really understand it as, I argue, as a self-organized period of rupture, right? There's a way in which certain traditions of political struggle denigrate what they call spontaneous protests, spontaneous uprisings, as chaotic, as lacking in kind of ideas, when in reality, the mere fact of their spontaneity doesn't mean that people don't know why they're in the streets and protesting, right? So we should understand them, I think, as potentially more self-organized forms of protest. But nonetheless, right, that does open you up. That lack of organizational structure does open you up to potential co-optation, especially by populist movements on the right. And this is a point that Fanon really drew out in his study of the anti-colonial movements, particularly his chapter called The Grandeur and Weakness of Spontaneity, right? When he's looking to who the most active subjects of anti-colonial revolt are going to be. And part of what he's telling us is that we have to slightly stretch our Marxism when we apply it to the colonies. And one of the ways it needs to be stretched, he says, is that in the colonies and the anti-colonial movement, it might not be the working class, the formally organized working class, workers in factories organized under the banner of unions that are leading the anti-colonial structure or that are the most radical subjects. Instead, he says that it's these more spontaneous revolts coming from what he referred to as the lumpen proletariat, those who are potentially underemployed or unemployed, but living in the city, working in the illicit economy, in the informal economy, or the peasantry that take the lead in forms of spontaneous revolt, and therefore constitute a kind of vanguard of the anti-colonial struggle, but who also, because of that spontaneous form of revolt, can potentially be co-opted or engage in acts that might be lead to further repression by the colonial government. And this is something that was lionized and portrayed on film through the Battle of Algiers, right? You can see that Gillo Pontecorvo is clearly playing with the notions of the grandeur and weakness of spontaneity as theorized by Fanon. So we saw something similar during this second sequence of post-apartheid revolt from 2004 to 2012 in terms of the strengths and weaknesses of spontaneous or self-organized forms of revolt.
Yeah, so during this second sequence or second phase of revolt, Abahlali emerged in 2005. So did Abahlali, the Shack Dwellers Movement, did it conform in the way it was structured or organized to the typical ways that people agitated and protested during the second phase?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. It stood apart from the broader trends of this second phase in the sense that it was formally organized. It had a leadership structure. It had an organizational mission. It had a series of practices that it focused around, which was primarily oriented around supporting the struggles of people living in shacks, right? Informal housing, as it's more commonly referred to. But on the other hand, it was very attentive to what it called the anger of the poor. And it sought to dignify that anger rather than denounce it or to steer it from the top, lead it from the top. So in a sense, they followed the Zapatista notion of leading by obeying. And they sought to operate in a way that would be loyal to that anger of the poor while avoiding the potential pitfalls of that anger. And so that's why they argued at the time and have continued to argue that the anger of the poor can go in many directions, right? Sometimes those can be progressive, but at other times those protests might be co-opted either by the state or by populist figures and turn inward on their own communities, most prominently in the form of attacks on migrant communities, right? And that's the kind of anger of the poor that Abahlali wanted to avoid by seeking to structure these protests and their own initiatives through a more organized body, right? Which would follow the parameters, in some senses, of those earlier new social movements.
Let's talk about the shack dwellers, the residents of these shack settlements. You write that about 500,000 people live in shacks and informal settlements in Durban. What are living conditions like in these settlements? And how did people, I think many of them came from the countryside, migrated from the countryside and moved to these areas. Who owned this land? Who had this land before these people occupied it?
Yeah, the living conditions are quite difficult. Most often, these shack communities, especially when they are initially set up, do not have access to piped running water, to sanitation, do not have access to formal electricity, and do not have access to formal roads or building structures that could offer a certain degree of security or tenancy. And so most generally, you could describe these conditions as extremely precarious, right? Existentially precarious. Because as you know, if you don't have access to running water, you have to find it yourself. That water might be contaminated. If you don't have access to formal sanitation, you may inadvertently contaminate that local water supply, right? Which can lead to all sorts of diseases. If you don't have access to electricity, you still have to cook your food at home to survive, but you tend to do that in these communities through paraffin stoves, which can often tip over in these cramped quarters and set the structures that you're in on fire. And because of the incredibly cramped conditions of these communities, when one shack lights on fire, others quickly catch fire right nearby. And because of the inability to access these communities, the ways in which they're stigmatized by the state, neglected by the state, right? These communities can light up and many people can die really quickly as a result of those conditions. So they're really difficult conditions that people live in. But we should also remember that these are also communities, they're neighborhoods. They're places where neighbors take care of each other, look out for each other's children, where people laugh, where people celebrate, where kids play. There are entire life worlds that are produced in these very same communities, which are certainly very precarious, but also the center of people's world in many cases. Now, the second part of your question about how these communities come into existence and what land they occupy, they could be squatting on public or private land. Oftentimes, it might be publicly held land that the state owns, but is deemed inhospitable or uninhabitable for people because of its precarious terrain. So that might be on a hillside that's too steep for normal buildings to be authorized to be built. Or in the case of Abahlali's, one of their most early prominent communities was located on the Kennedy Road shack settlement, which was immediately adjacent to the municipal dump site. So we're talking about a very toxic area, right? And as you pointed out, many of the people who end up residing in these communities are moving from their former rural homelands, which the apartheid government had confined them to and imprisoned them in, essentially. And part of what post-apartheid freedom meant for them was the freedom to move to the city, which was seen as a site of more opportunity, greater access potentially to employment or to education for their children, or to access to services like healthcare that they needed. But because the apartheid spatial planning had zoned these areas as exclusively white, or in rare instances in the outlying suburbs where they were townships where they needed cheap labor, either as colored or Indian or African, these rural migrants into the city were really transgressing the former apartheid geographies. But because no land redistribution had occurred, they were forced to occupy these abandoned spots of land in the interstices of post-apartheid urban geographies.
That's the voice of Yusuf Al-Balushi. You can find a spelling of his name as well as a link to his new book, Ruptures in the Afterlife of the Apartheid City, on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm CS. The book explores how shack dwellers in South Africa are confronting the persistent legacy of spatial segregation by experimenting with novel modes of political organization. Tell us about the leadership structure of Abahlali and how a locality, a local settlement, right? There are dozens of settlements, shack settlements in and around Durban. How a locality could, or many of its residents could, join the organization, might come on board and become part of this shack dwellers movement.
Yeah, so Abahlali has a central leadership structure that is elected by the broader movement at its annual meeting. It also has parallel bodies. It has a women's league and it has a youth league. But that central leadership body does not have a say in terms of what local chapters, local branches, as they call them in the movement, can and should do. In fact, the principle of the movement is really organized around direct democracy. The way that a new branch of the movement can be formed is when at least 50 residents in any particular shack community, say Kennedy Road, as we talked about earlier, get together and they decide amongst themselves that they would like to affiliate with Abahlali Basim Jondolo. And they then approach Abahlali's central decision-making body to petition the movement for membership. And that's when Abahlali will ask them, okay, as long as you have a minimum of 50 potential members, then we want you to decide amongst yourselves who is going to represent your community, right? So you're going to elect a local leadership structure. And quite often in these initial meetings, those residents of a particular shack community might be thinking along the lines of a traditional political party, expecting Abba Hlali to do things for them. And so what one of the first things Abba Hlali tells a newly forming branch is that you are going to have to determine your own destiny. The central principle of our movement is an insistence on the capacity of the poor to think for themselves. And that means that you know best what the problems are in your local community. Those might be struggles around access to water. There might be struggles with a corrupt ward counselor. They might be struggles for education, right? You know best what those struggles are and will look like. And we are here as a broader movement to support your initiatives rather than to direct your struggle.
Talking about the movement repertoire of this group is difficult because it is, as you write, quite varied, and it probably varies, as you said, depending on the needs, specific needs of the local branch of the shack settlement. But do give us some examples. What are some ways in which groups have mobilized to try and achieve their goals, whether it be housing or basic services or just greater dignity?
Yeah, the repertoire of Abba Hlali is quite varied, and it includes a whole series of practices in part that are aimed around meeting the bare necessities for survival. So as I described earlier, many of these shack communities, at least initially, may not have access to electricity, to running water, to sanitation. And so struggle electricians often emerge in these settings in which the formal electricity grid is hacked into, and the movement might facilitate such electrical connections to meet people's needs. They might facilitate organizing access to clean water or organizing the installation of a series of dry toilets or access to proper forms of sanitation. They may also quite often organize community creches, which are child care centers. Child care is a big issue in these communities, and those community creches can form a kind of center of social life in these shack communities where children gather and where different people might volunteer to take turns in taking care of those children in the neighborhood. They might also include organizing forms of community gardening to meet people's needs to grow their own food on nearby land. But they also might take the form of more politically antagonistic forms of organizing, like organizing protests, right? Supporting citizens when they recognize that the existing formal structures of political representation that are intended to meet their needs have broken down or are failed or have been seized by corrupt actors at the local ward council level. And so Abba Hlali actions in those contexts might include organizing direct actions to protest their local municipal leaders, their local ward councilors, taking on the state directly, disrupting traffic in order to draw attention to their condition, organizing formal marches across the city, not just in their community, that often happens. They organized an annual Unfreedom Day that really challenges the notion that in 1994, South Africans realized freedom for the first time in overthrowing apartheid. They're keen to point out the continuities between apartheid and post-apartheid politics. And this Unfreedom Day gathers thousands of their memberships in a single community or in a downtown meeting hall to share speeches and analyses of the conjuncture and to celebrate their struggles. They may also have other forms of social mobilization that are rooted in everyday life, things like soccer leagues, community choirs. They may form alliances with local religious groups. These are all examples of things that Abba Hlali engages in to sustain and strengthen their community. In addition to those, there's a couple ones that stand out that are really important. And these take the form of community meetings in which the first action in response to a problem that's presented at a local community is not to necessarily react, but it's to deliberate, to interrogate, to analyze that problem. And the space for analyzing, interrogating problems, they refer to as the University of the Poor. So they will engage in meetings that are quite protracted at a local level, at a citywide level, in which they study their problems, they debate their problems, and in which the mode of debating and discussing is one that really puts front and center the knowledge that is gained by living in these shack communities above the knowledge of outside experts or people who want to speak on their behalf. Right? They're really insistent that they have the capacity to think and to understand and to plan the cities from below as a result of these protracted discussions and study sessions that occur in the setting of what they refer to as the University of the Poor, University of Abatlali. And they use that language in order to insist on equality in exchanges, equality on of forms of knowledge when they do engage with outside experts whose knowledge they do not discount. It's important to state. They are eager to work with, whether it be professors or technical policy experts or scientists or even government officials, as long as those people treat them with the respect and equality that doesn't imply that they just need services delivered to them from on high and that they don't know how to best govern their own community. So those are some of the main activities that the movement engages in on any given day of the year.
If, as you write, political education is crucial to the shack dweller movement, to what extent have movement participants engaged with ideas emanating from the Black radical tradition and with understandings of what racial capitalism is and how it works?
Yeah, so these terms, racial capitalism and the Black radical tradition, are not necessarily terms that I heard in movement spaces, but they're terms that I think resonate quite powerfully with the kinds of discussions that Abatlali had in their spaces of political education. Part of the reason why I use them in this book as a mechanism to understand the South African context and to understand the initiative of a movement like Abatlali relates to the reality, which is becoming more and more well known now, that this term racial capitalism in part originated amongst South Africans during the anti-apartheid struggle as a way to try and describe the relationship between class and race under conditions of apartheid government that was nonetheless a capitalist government. And as the rest of the world was decolonizing and moving towards what was thought to be non-racial, anti-racist futures, right, in the sense that people of color around the world were going to enjoy the status of self-determination, South Africa was moving stronger and more forcefully into a racially segmented society. And so it's in that context that theorists in South Africa began to describe capitalism as necessarily racial in the South African context, right? Which is to say, demarcated according to the lines of social difference in the South African context. So class struggle and struggle against racism had to go hand in hand. And of course, that's part of the inspiration for Cedric Robinson's theorization of racial capitalism, one that he applies now to the world as a whole and to capitalism as a whole, insisting that capitalism does not need to the formation of more and more homogeneous working class subjects, but in fact is always going to rely upon forms of differentiation between the working class, especially, but not exclusively, along the lines of race, right, all around the world. And so if we situate post-apartheid South Africa in the context of a global racial capitalism, it helps us better understand why it is that racism was not overthrown when apartheid was overthrown. It changed form. We have, in a sense, a new racial regime, but it's still a racial regime, right? Because it's in the context of this broader system that Cedric Robinson, I think, rightly referred to as racial capitalism. On the other hand, who are the subjects of resistance in the face of racial capitalism? And in South Africa, there's a really rich tradition of radical struggle. There's a rich tradition of institutionalized forms of Marxism and communism. There's a rich tradition of Black radical movements as well. But often that rich tradition of institutionalized left politics, most prominently in the forms of the South African Communist Party, or at best in kind of Trotskyist dissident offshoots from the Communist Party, those Marxist intellectuals and political activists who saw the South African Communist Party as complicit with the post-apartheid forms of consensus that the ANC helped bring about, right? Not challenging inequality, but kind of buttressing that inequality. They still, despite their important contributions to struggle and to radical thought, tend to view the South African landscape of radical struggles through traditional categories of resistance, such as the worker. So in this context, in a very caricatured sense, it's understood within communist parties and even within Trotskyist political parties that the working class, thought to be formally employed, working in factories, organized under the banner of a union, can best bring about radical change and a more equal society. Now, there's a problem with this idea, or a challenge that faces this idea in a society like South Africa, where anywhere from 1 in 3 to 1 in 2 people lacks formal employment.
Yusuf Al-Balushi is his name. He teaches in the Department of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine. We are talking about his new book, Ruptures in the Afterlife of the Apartheid City. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Right, I mean, these are not factory workers. These are not people with formal employment. They work in the informal economy. And so how does that rhetoric or figure of the worker as sort of leading, possibly leading the revolutionary charge, play with very poor people in South Africa, and specifically, in this case, shack settlement dwellers in Durban?
Yeah, it's not that the shack dwellers or that poor people would be against those ideas. They still believe in a strong, organized working class. Many of them may have worked in factories and been a part of the anti-apartheid resistance and the radical unions that helped bring down the apartheid government. However, as you're hinting, right, in a context of mass unemployment, and certainly in shack communities, it's less struggles around the workplace, right, around at the point of production, than it is struggles in the community around the point of social reproduction, meeting the bare needs of everyday life, that are highlighted by such movements. And because of that shift from the point of production in the factory to community settings and struggles around a home and access to urban land, sometimes these movements are a little bit less legible to those traditional Trotskyist or Communist Party models of political organization. And it's for that reason that I find the notion of a Black radical tradition quite useful in this regard. When people ask what forms of struggle, how would you describe this shack dweller movement, Abahlali? I think the Black radical tradition is a really good tradition, because for me, the Black radical tradition is always in relationship to other forms of radicalism, to Marxism, to socialist struggles, right? Abahlali identifies explicitly as a socialist movement. They sing the Internationale at many of their meetings these days, right? But it's not as workers that they identify primarily, or as organized workers working within a union structure that they mobilize politically. And they also draw upon aspects of what Cedric Robinson termed the Black radical tradition, including kind of a more metaphysical approach to political change, right? There is a kind of religious undercurrent to their movement, a kind of Black liberation theology current. There may be prayers said at their meetings, although they often insist that when they invoke religion, it's not the religion of the mainstream churches that promise you liberation in the afterlife. They're fighting for liberation here and now, and there Jesus Christ is a defender of the poor, not a defender of the prosperous, right, that the prosperity gospel preaches. But nonetheless, you do see elements of a kind of spiritual tradition that is invoked. You also see traditions of anti-colonial resistance from the Impondo revolt in nearby provinces that people will invoke as a part of their genealogy of struggles, of what they bring to the table. And those traditions of resistance are a little bit less legible and more neglected in the kind of communist currents or the Trotskyist currents of struggle that tend to dominate in the radical spaces of the university and other movements in society. So it's for that reason that I think Abahlali squarely fits within this kind of Black radical tradition as described by Cedric Robinson and as invoked by prior movements in South Africa, like the Black Consciousness Movement under Steve Biko's leadership.
You refer in your book to the inclination of many people in South Africa to think outside of race. So there's a certain reluctance to bring up race. Talk about that.
You know, when I first got to South Africa in 2011, I was really struck by the extent to which I felt like society was operating according to colorblindness in a society that was clearly still defined along racist lines to me. It seemed so obvious. But people were shy to even use that language to describe their society, in part because I think they bought into the idea that to use the language of race was to reproduce racism, right? That old idea we're familiar with in the United States. But at the same time, as I spent more time there, and as this second sequence of revolt passed into a third sequence of revolt, and new movements like the economic freedom fighters emerged that weren't shy about talking about the ongoing racism in their society, and then new movements like the Roads Must Fall, Feeds Must Fall student movement emerged that were arguing for the need to decolonize South African educational landscape, there was a rise in forms of Black consciousness, right? A reawakening of Black consciousness and of explicitly racialized forms of political identity. Now, in that context, I was somewhat surprised that Abahlali was somewhat hesitant to deploy racial categories of either identity or as descriptors for what they were fighting against. They would use that language, right? It often surfaced in movement statements or in movement meetings when people would decry the fact, why are we so poor and why are the Black poor always the ones who suffer the most, right? But it was a hesitant deployment of either racial political identities or even the term Black to describe who they were, or anti-Blackness or racism to describe what they were fighting against. And eventually I learned that they were hesitant to go down that road, not for the same reasons that mainstream South African liberal colorblind society was. They were hesitant to use that language for, I think, two reasons. One, they saw the ways in which that supposedly anti-racist discourse had already been co-opted by a very populist authoritarian wing of the ANC under Jacob Zuma, right, who has now broken with the ANC and formed his own Nkonto Wesizwe political party, which just had tremendous success in the last election, winning 15% of the votes and almost half the votes in KwaZulu-Natal. It's really an ethnically nationalist, Zulu nationalist party that uses the language of fighting white capitalist interests in order to enrich itself, in order to enrich a new Black elite, right? And with no interest really in supporting the Black masses. So it's an instrumentalist use of anti-racist discourse in the name of authoritarian populist politics that is quite conservative and horrific in many ways. So that was one reason why Abahlali was hesitant to go down a road that might be confused with that already existing circulating discourse. And the other reason, which I think is something we can take away from their politics, even though they recognize racism and they do talk about it as part of what they're fighting against, they are somewhat hesitant at times to always reduce their struggle to an anti-racist struggle, in part because they understand both the inextricably bound up nature of race and class, but they also believe in a form of universal humanity, right? And they are always insistent upon this, that a person is a person no matter where they find themselves on planet Earth. And that forms the basis of their internationalist politics, which has always been at the foreground of what they do, right? This is why, as South Africans who are at the bottom of a racial order and a global order, they can always stand up for Palestinian struggles and protests on October 8th in the streets of Durban alongside Palestinian struggles. It's why they persistently come out against attacks on migrants, whether those migrants are from other parts of Africa or from South Asia, because they argue that a person is a person no matter where they find themselves. So their politics, although it is anti-racist, and while they recognize the persistence of racial capitalism in the post-apartheid context, is also always insistent on a kind of a form of what the Ghanaian political philosopher Ato Seki Otu calls a left universalism, right? One that buys into the notion still and still holds on to some form of universal humanity in a Fanonist sense, in a sense like Sylvia Winter. And that's how they can form their international alliances around the world. And that's what explains why they're interested in working with anyone, regardless of their racial, ethnic, gender, national, religious background.
We have just scratched the surface of my guest Yusuf Al-Balushi's new book, Ruptures in the Afterlife of the Apartheid City. He is Associate Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine. Yusuf, congratulations on your new book, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, CS. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
And that interview was recorded on August 12th, 2024. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.